today we're going to have a presentation, and I'm going to let our committee administrator introduce folks, and he's got this well organized. So Jan, if you would...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, James Thorne from the Governor's Office is here today to talk about the Governor's Budget and Ballot Measure 1, and Linda Ames is here from the Department of Administrative Services to do a PowerPoint presentation on the Governor's Budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm James Thorne. I'm the Governor's Education and Workforce Policy Advisor. It's good to be back in this session. I saw many of you last session on this committee. Linda gets to do the technical work today. I also, and some of you may have seen some of this before in other presentations to Ways and Means. I suggested she stay light on the numbers and we'll go heavier on the policy, hopefully, to give you a sense of some of the recommendations that are contained in the governor's budget for the entire education spectrum. And when we do get to K-12, I'd like to take a moment to talk about ballot measure 1 and its requirements and how we're attempting through this budget to address the requirements in ballot measure 1. To frame the budget a little bit, and those of you who are in Ways and Means, probably most of you have heard this comment already, but I guess I'd like to step back a little bit. Before starting the budget process of developing the governor's recommended budget, we recognized that there was going to be a significant gap between projected expenditures of continuing current programs and other liabilities and lawsuits that were made, and projected revenues. And the passage of Measure 88 added so that we're looking anywhere at a $700 to $800 million gap between projected expenditures and projected revenue. And so that made putting the budget together quite difficult. As probably all of you know, because you've been through this before, most of our past sessions have been involved in looking at how to split up additional money instead of how do we deal with shortfalls. With a gap of this size, it really required that we look at policy choices and not just spinning the soup or you can squeeze a little bit out here and there. Because in many cases, as these agencies have gone through changes over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of squeezing already, and that we really were at a point where we couldn't just be looking at how to deal with some issues in the margin. In many ways, I think, as I've heard the governor speak before, and I've used this, it was what legitimate need will go unmet so that we can meet another legitimate need of a higher priority. In looking at priorities, I think there were several things that the governor had in mind and reflected in the budgets for the education agencies. First of all, across state government, he really asked the agencies look at their core mission. What is it they had to do that no one else could do? What were the functions or the services that, although they may be valuable, were ones that perhaps in looking at priorities might be of a lower priority? At the same time, he wanted to not just say, given that we have the size of gap, we can't look at changes that may allow us to invest so that in the long term we can hopefully decrease some of the costs that we have in state government. When you look at public safety issues, compliance in our corrections system, compliance in human services, in many cases you see the results of school failure. School failure, in fact, is one of the highest correlated measures, I guess, with the number people who are in our service or in our system that services that could hopefully be prevented. And so he wanted to look at how do we reallocate as we're looking at our core mission and we're looking at those services that may be less than core or more than core, I guess. Could we reallocate to the front end, given that research shows that so many of these issues, if we deal at the very front end, children's lives from birth and prenatal on, and they allow us to address some of the longer-term issues. And so, as you know, he developed the Oregon Children's Plan, which does look at and would put in place a system of identification, triage, and services for infants through grade school. At the same time, he saw that if we're going to really deal with some of the issues in making the kind of long-term investment, one of the more critical, or maybe the key critical long-term investment, is in education. And at the same time as he wanted to make an investment in education, we finally had some tools at our disposal for the quality education model that would really allow us to do a better job of being able to define what should we be able to expect, what could we buy, given various resource levels in our K-12 schools. So what you'll see today is that although I think in the education arena, you'll see investment probably more so than in some of the other service areas throughout state government, you'll also see trade-offs. And as I explained to the committee of the Board of Higher Education yesterday, who a little more of the trade-offs than the trade-ins, these were difficult decisions, but there really was no agency that were able to escape some of the trade-offs. Many of those would have been necessary, probably most of them would have been necessary to make work. So as we go through the budget, as we go through the various parts of the budget today, I hope that helps you understand some of the policy framework that was behind the choices that were made in the governor's recommended budget for education. And from there, I'll turn to Linda. She's the technician who can walk us through some of this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with the Budget and Management Division of DAS. I work with several of the education agencies, the State School Fund, Community Colleges, and Student Assistance Commissions. And I've been prepared to do some overview on higher ed and the Department of Ed as we go through here.
Have we dimmed these lights as much as we think we should?
And you have handouts as well, so I think it's hard. These are the agencies in the education program area, Department of Ed, Community Colleges, Higher Education, I think everyone's familiar with. The Student Assistance Commission is the agency that does all the financial aid. As we go through this presentation, I'll probably focus mostly on general fund lottery resources. They administer the NEED grant program in that area. Teacher Standards is the agency that teacher licensing and regulation, and they don't receive general funds, and I won't be talking about those today. This is a statewide overview, and here we're just looking at general fund lottery expenditures for 0103. You can see how much of the general fund it really is used for education. And this isn't anything new, and it's just this biennium. State school fund funding at 43% of all state general fund and lottery, with higher ed at 7%, community colleges 4%, and other education is mostly the Department of Education at 3%. This is the education program area itself, and there you see school funding at 3/4 of all the general fund lottery. This looks at education as a percent of all the state general fund, and you can't really talk about the education funding and how it's affected the rest of the state budget without going back to Measure 5 and what it and the decreases in property tax that then were picked up by state funding. Back before Measure 5, in that first, education was under half, 45% of all state funding. The last three biennia, percent in the high 50s. Hispania actually a little lower than the last two, which isn't what you would generally expect when you hear about the governor's budget increasing education and giving cuts in other areas. Seeing really hit on these core principles already. This is a high-level summary of the various investments in education, the primary and secondary education, and I'm going to hit all these in a little more detail. This kind of gets it all up front. Use of the quality ed model to formulate the K-12 budget on the school improvement fund, specifically targeted to K-5 literacy, and some smaller packages, assistance to low-performing schools, student dropout prevention, teacher mentor. In the community colleges, a substantial increase to cover enrollment growth. In higher education, expand access to four-year degrees in Central Oregon, engineering education, and expanded biotechnology research capacity at OHSU. And then a small expansion in the NEED grant for the Student Assistance Commission. Now I'll go into a little more of the details for the K-12 school funding. This is not the Department of Ed operations, but the funding that goes out directly to schools. Here you see more specifically the effect of the property tax measures. The bottom of the columns is the property tax mostly, and you see the decline in that, and then the large increase in state funding in order to meet needs in that area. Back in 91-93, the state portion of school funding was under 30%. It's now close to 70%. The governor's budget for school funding really tried to address two major issues. One was adequate current service level. Executive Order 9915, about a year and a half ago, established the School Revenue Forecast Committee. That was a group set up to provide a three-year forecast of current service level for schools. There were really two purposes to that group and process. One was to provide a planning tool for districts who needed to be able to have some idea ahead what they might expect as they're making contracts and commitments for the following years. Second was to bring the stakeholder community and education together to get some agreement on a reasonable current service level. That group included various technical people around the state, Legislative Revenue Office, Legislative Fiscal Office, Department of Education, finance people, people at budget management, then in June, then other stakeholders like COSA and OSBA, Oregon Education Association. The legislative representative was Representative Strobeck in that group. And this is an ongoing process. We put the first forecast out in early May, and another forecast must have just gone out from the Department of Education to school districts. One of the major changes that came out of this group in this process, different from past biennia in the current service level, involved the calculation of the personal services costs. We tried to address that more realistically, more specifically in the methodology than had been done in the past, and tried to bring it a little more in line with state agencies. Since we know each position and its cost for state agencies, we fund them exactly at what personal services will cost. For schools, we don't know that. We don't have a position-by-position type system for teachers like we do for the state. So there were estimates in order to get a more realistic number for current service level generally. The other major budget issue and change is the use of the quality education model to help determine what resources are needed to ensure that students meet standards. Jean's going to elaborate on that a little bit.
I think most of you are probably aware of the quality education model that was originally developed under a council that Representative Lynn Lundquist had chaired, and I believe Hartung may have sat in on that as well. The work of that council came out midway through the last session, and I think that even though there were discussions around it, some concerns about how much had the model been reviewed, what kind of input, how valid was the model. And the model was not subsequently used as a basis for making a decision on school funding during the last session. But I think certainly the governor felt strongly that we needed to move our discussions and our decision-making into a different direction so that we had a better base for making the decisions on K-12. So there was $300,000 was allocated to the Oregon Department of Education to take the next step in developing the quality education model. The governor and Stan Bunn, through executive order, appointed a new commission, the Quality Education Commission, to take a fresh look at the model, but the charge was to validate and refine the model. I've given you a copy of a publication that the Oregon School Board Association has done on the model, and this was done, actually came out, I think, the same day as the governor's budget, so it doesn't say what we were doing in the governor's budget. But I think it's a good summary of what went into the model, the type of national review that was part of it, a public opinion survey that fed into it, I think some work from one of the panels or a couple of the panels, and then ultimately inside you'll see something about the baseline schools versus the full model schools. Baseline schools, in essence, are, if you look at prototypes, if you assume an elementary school of 340, a middle school of 500, and a high school of 1,000. They took data from the schools in Oregon and said, on average, now there's on average, what are the class sizes in elementary, middle school, high school? How much is being spent on textbooks per student? How much is being spent on maintenance? How much teacher training, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farioli.
I have a question about the quality education model, if I might, please.
Certainly.
The model was and is subject to lots of debate and question and wonderment in a couple of cases. But I don't remember if the legislature ever took action to ask the various departments to implement the model as a planning tool or to organize our approach to education funding based on the model. And I guess when I saw the publication of the quality education model the first time, I thought, well, that's great. We might as well throw a brick at the moon. And the bottom line is that the cost of the quality education model was so far beyond our capability to finance that for me it was essentially holding up an unattainable standard. When we're all working hard, and we'll be working hard, I think, in this legislative session to put every dollar that's available into funding education. But then to use a document that's never been adopted as an organizational structure in the legislative process, or even been, as far as I know, officially recognized as a way that we should organize our thinking and our actions about this very important issue, seems to me to be an area where we at least have to do more bridge building before we see these things expressed as a set of objectives that should organize Oregon education. So I guess I see an awful lot more work to do between planners and thinkers and philosophers and educators and administrators and legislators who have to, you know, basically put their stamp of approval on these things with a vote, before we could use the Oregon education model as an organizing principle for funding our schools.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, in response to that, this was developed through this latest iteration was developed through an executive order. That's correct. What you will see, and as I get into Measure 1, is that with the requirements under Measure 1 to determine sufficiency, how does one determine what's sufficient, the level of insufficiency, how does one determine how insufficient, and the impacts of the insufficiency, how does one determine what the impacts might be. The governor believes, and has proposed legislation starting on the House side, that would establish that the Quality Education Commission would establish, look at best practices, the cost of those best practices would go through a process similar to what this commission has done, and then would establish that the governor and the legislature, in issuing their budget, would, because it requires the legislature to report, would report against that. So I certainly think there will be opportunities, and there should be opportunities, both for this committee to have a full understanding of the quality education model, and there are commissioners who could come in and do the full hour presentation and answer your questions and go into much more detail also of the various committees. Plus, there will be a bill before come before the committee that would be the implementing legislation for Measure 1 that would establish the work of Quality Education Commission as from here and into the future on a regular basis as being the way to frame the decision-making around a K-12 budget.
Okay. Well, Mr. Freeman, I agree with what I've heard here. The only caveat I think I would adhere to is this one. The work of the committee is and the commission is prospective, but we have clear expressions of the their conclusions reflected in the governor's budget. And so I think that we are in a situation that I find myself often in, which is ready, fire, aim. And so I'm wondering if we haven't stepped ahead of the process of getting understanding of the quality education model, buy-off by legislators, use of that model for prioritization, and then a legislatively adopted budget. Instead, what we have is a proposed budget by the governor using these models, and now we're going to try and engage legislators after that fact to use this model as the model that expresses Senate Bill Number 1's obligations. And to my knowledge, I don't know of any legislators that have said that the quality education model is the way we will discharge our obligation under Senate Bill 1.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ferriero, I would really suggest bringing in the commission. This constitutional amendment is in effect now, and part of the timing issue is the need for implementing legislation. The governor's proposal to implement would be to utilize the work of it. I think an important piece, and as you, if you have the commission come in and present the model, important piece that the commission discusses in their presentation is that the model isn't only about establishing a number, a final number, a full model number. It really provides a policy tool for policymakers to understand, a tool for policymakers to understand the ramifications of funding at various levels. And I think as I go through Measure 1 and how the governor used the quality ed model to meet requirements under Measure 1, I think it might become a little more clear of how this now provides us something better than pulling numbers out of the air and trying to guess at what the impact is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I could be wrong on this, but my understanding about Measure 1, at least as one citizen that voted on it, is in some ways I'm mandated by the citizens of Oregon now, because I believe the model was in ballot Measure 1 or referenced as the funding, and you may be getting to this, and so in some ways I know going into session I was thinking this is now part of the Oregon fabric as put it on by the citizens of Oregon through ballot Measure 1.
Mr. Chair and Senator Decker, if I can address that as I go through here in terms, because I have the actual language from Measure 1 here, we can repeat that. In looking again, rather than pulling a number out and trying to figure out what it is we should be expecting of schools, the commission, first of all, they realized last year, last May, as they were working towards finalizing the full model after they'd had all the reporting come in, that the cost of the full model was going to be more than was going to be available. The cost of the full model beyond current service level is about close to $1 billion. What's interesting is that as they finished that part of the work and they looked at the amount per student, the amount per ADMW, that it would cost to deliver this full model, and then they looked back at spending in the early 90s prior to Measure 5 adjusting for inflation, it was about at the same level. I think it really spoke to, and that was an average back in the early 90s, that the model wasn't especially extravagant. It's that because of the kind of changes that have occurred over the last several years and the squeezing down on the school budgets, that we've been spending less and less on an inflation-adjusted basis. And now we're really looking at, and the model really assumes high performance. And there are a number of factors that I won't get into all of them here because you need a full presentation on it. But that with the kind of focus that had that was assumed and in the structure of the model, that they believed it was reasonable to expect that 90% of students over time, and there's a timeline they have in there, could meet or exceed the state standards. The governor had asked the commission in the spring to look also at what priorities might be for phase in, knowing, and frankly, the commission even said, even if there were $1 billion on the, that could be put on the table for schools, it would be hard for the schools to use it effectively in that kind of lump sum because they needed to develop the capacity. This doesn't include capital costs. They needed to be able to look at where their needs for expanded facilities, how would they hire the teachers, et cetera. So the commission spent a lot of time discussing what their priorities were. They looked at the priorities that had been developed by the education leadership team, which came out of the last session. And the team, as you may remember, includes the speaker, the Senate president, the governor, the superintendent of public instruction, the community college commissioner, the labor commissioner, and the higher ed chancellor, along with 14 other members. And Senator Hartung was one of those members. One of the four priorities that had been identified by that group was a focus on early reading, that if you can get kids to read early, that will really set them well to be successful in the rest of their educational experience. So the commission looked at, if you were going to phase this in, given that we don't have the type of money to do that in one swoop, what would you do? And they said we should focus on trying to get 90% of third and fifth graders to reading benchmarks within 4 years. Now, in using the model, we then looked at what are two, in working with the members, especially the educator members of the commission and the consultants, what would be the components of the model that if you were in a prototype school would be most likely in a cost-effective manner to allow you to reach those targets. Those are our targets. We're not starting with them, we're starting with targets. And here are two examples that both the first and second example include, in essence, the full amount of the model for textbook supplies and equipment, the additional time for students that meet standards, the additional professional development time for teachers and administrators that have been recommended. The first example would not require additional capital. We brought in a reading specialist that would work with other teachers and with students in diagnosing reading issues and assisting in reading instruction, plus a half-time instructional improvement staff to really work with the teachers in better aligning curriculum and improving instruction. They believe that would be one model that should be reasonable to expect 90% of third and fifth graders reading standards in 4 years. The second example, rather than those last two components, included class size reduction in K-3 from an average of 24 to 20. Now, it doesn't cover the capital cost. What the model allowed us to do was look at, for each of those components, if you roll up those costs to an aggregated statewide level, how much does that cost? And so, either example, the cost was about $220 million over the baseline current service level cost on a statewide level. So it allowed us to be thinking about what could you buy, and with the, if you utilize the resources in this way, would it be reasonable to expect that these goals would be met? Schools would be free to utilize them in a different way. We still, though, did not have $220 million to invest in this.
Mr. Chair,
Whitley.
If I may ask a question, unless you want to continue and hold questions till the end.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Thank you. In the two examples, additional professional development for teachers is listed as the third item on the list. Why is it not number one? If I'm reading it as a prioritized list, why is it not number one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gorley, it's not a prioritized list. I think what was the commission wanted to make sure people didn't understand it was one thing or another. But the combination of these things that they felt would allow, having the good textbooks and materials, if it makes a difference, you need to have the teachers be trained so they can really utilize that and work more closely with students. For those students who were having difficulty, they needed some additional time after school. So this isn't prioritized, it's the grouping of things together that they felt would allow to meet them. The governor, in talking and looking at the budget and talking also with some of the stakeholder groups, that we don't have $220 million. We were at a place where that was not going to be possible. But just as elsewhere in the budget, there's been a reprioritization to focus on the early years. He said he did not believe it was unreasonable to expect that there could be a reprioritization on the early years in the schools. What the model allowed us to do was actually look at, I'll get to this in a moment, the Measure 1 report, was to look at, if you were to do that, what might that mean, as opposed to saying schools can squeeze out $110 million. This allows us to better look at what the real impact might be. Now, I think you all have about Measure 1 report in front of you. And actually, you'll see, in reading glasses, so I'll try to see if I can, in small font, there are actually two parts to Measure 1. One required the legislature to establish some local option equalization grants, and the governor is proposing some implementing legislation on that. But the part about Measure 1 that this report refers to requires the legislative assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets quality goals established by law. Sufficiency is being tied to the quality goals established by law, and publish a report that either demonstrates the appropriation is sufficient or identifies the reasons for the insufficiency, its extent, and its impact on the ability of the state system of public education to meet those goals. The governor wasn't required to issue that Measure 1 report, but he has, and in the implementing legislation that he's proposing, it would require that the governor issue one as well. And so the governor utilized the Quality Education Commission report. As you can see here, he says it's not sufficient to ensure that. It does not appropriate the funding levels estimated.
Excuse me, Senator Perioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the speaker does approach the question that I asked earlier about whether or not the constitutional amendment refers to the quality education model. I don't know of an instance that the quality education model has been enacted into law. So clearly the measure could not be referring to the quality education model. I think the reference in the law is to the certificates of initial mastery benchmarks and the certificates of advanced mastery benchmarks. And further, the law, the constitutional amendment, requires the legislature to provide for the reporting. So I'm wondering if, again, if the cart isn't before the horse because the legislature has not issued such a report. So, again, Mr. Chairman, my concern is that the governor's to be lauded for taking the initiative. I think it gives us a good basis to do our deliberations and to create the legislative report that's required by the constitutional amendment. But to have anyone represent that the quality education model is constitutionally required is simply at variance with the facts.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farrell, if I might go on, because I think I'll be addressing both your question and Senator Deckard's question. The the governor has utilized the model in developing his budget. He's issued a report. He's not required to do so. Ballot Measure 1 obviously requires implementing legislation. The governor is proposing, and the bill will be coming, of his proposal to establish that the commission be established in statute, appointed by the governor's, confirmed by the Senate, to carry out the requirements of determining the level of what would constitute sufficiency. There also is a clause in there that, because the amendment is in effect now, constitutional amendment is in effect now, that for purposes of the 0103 budget, that the work of the commission under the executive order would serve for the purposes. Obviously, that is a bill that needs to be heard and reviewed and discussed. The governor, in the absence of having a bill, is utilizing the model that was developed by this commission as a way to establish what would be sufficient.
So
the model is correct. The model is, and the commission is not established in the Constitution.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the question of separation of powers is an important one. We keep getting reminded by the executive branch how important it is. I guess it's my feeling that the governor's effort is a good effort, but that the report by the commission does not meet the legislatively required mandate by Senate 1. I mean, the bottom line is we've modified our Constitution. The legislature has an obligation. I don't believe the legislature's obligation is discharged or met by the governor's report or his executive order. And I'm just suggesting that the work that the governor's done in proposing the budget and putting forward the principles that it reflects of the quality education model are a great point of beginning, but it does not meet the legal requirement for the legislature's mandate that exists in the new constitutional amendment. And furthermore, there is no connection between the legislative requirement and the quality education model and the constitutional amendment. They are not connected.
That, I think, is relatively clear, and I appreciate you putting it on the record, but we will be deliberating on that during the course of this legislative session, and we're going to have a very open and full debate on that issue and come up with an answer.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Again, moving on, the governor has utilized the model. It's not sufficient. It's insufficient by $862 million. However, the budget addresses the priority targets identified by the Quality Education Commission. Now, as you move through this, then what it outlines how we've, first of all, how the governor's moved some money around to buy $220 million in the school improvement fund that would focus, and that's another bill that will be coming to you that would focus on achievement of these benchmarks. As far as the impact on the ability then to meet the goals, you have the examples of the investments that we've discussed at the elementary level. However, because we're also saying that it will require, we took $110 million was reduced from the state school fund, provides also examples of if those dollars at a local level are moved from middle school and high school in order to meet to live within the state school fund amount, we've then outlined the types of impacts that possibly could occur at the middle school and high school level. The offsets, and so for instance, and you can actually look at attachment B would show you for each of the levels that at the elementary, the middle school, and the high school, both examples of the additions that there would be at the elementary, I guess just examples at the elementary level. An example of how money might actually be moved away from middle school and high school. So it allows for a much better idea of what, if the puts and takes, what the actual impact might be at a school level. While $110 million would be reallocated, at the same time, I think as we move to the Department of Education's budget, you'll see that there are at least two program packages, policy packages that are funded in the governor's recommended budget that would primarily focus the middle school and high school level. One to assist low-performing schools, and the other to look at work on dropout prevention activities. These would be targeted programs in those schools that are most in need of this type of assistance. So then going back to the performance expectations, again, this is a very important link. This is the first time we've ever really tried to make that kind of link with the K-12 budget. That with the budget of $5.2 billion for K-12 schools, it would be expected that 90% of third and fifth graders would be meeting or exceeding the state reading benchmark within 4 years, which would be 2004-05. At the same time, although we wouldn't have the 90% goal, that there should be, because we'd be working on elementary school improvements, that there should be significant progress with the percentage of third and fifth graders meeting the math benchmark within 4 years. And then when we look at the 8th and 10th grade, and actually there's some charts back here that look like this, that look at expected performance levels under current service level versus full implementation of the QES, that the percentage of 8th and 10th graders should still, of meeting benchmarks, should continue to grow, but perhaps not as much as would have been expected under current service level scenario. Even under the current service level, there was assumed to be some growth in the percentage of 8th and 10th graders. Mm-hmm. So that outlines the governor's proposed budget for funding of K-12 schools, how it's tied to the quality education model, and then in turn how he's tied that to meet requirements under Measure One.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdley.
Thank you. Ms. Thorne and I have had a conversation recently about the 90% performance expectation, and she's heard me say that I'm concerned about the 10% and what our expectation is for those students. And so I ask that question again for the record. How has the Quality Education Commission talked about the 10%, and what are our expectations for those students, and what is the profile of those students?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Burley. Thank you for asking the question so I have an opportunity to respond on that. The commission made it clear in its deliberations that they were not saying leave 10% of the kids. That those students as well, there were expectations for growth for all students. There may be some students, we have high standards. These are not kind of basic minimum standards that, in the old system, I think something like 95% of students met basic proficiency. There may be some students because of physical, more likely mental or other problems who may not be able to actually meet the standards themselves, but the expectation would be that there certainly would be continued progress towards those standards. The issue of 90% was debated long, I know, by the original council and then also this one, because there are many who say it should be 100%, or expectation should be 100% of students. There were others who said 90% is too high. There will never be able to get 90% of students to standard. I think the commission felt it was that our standards are high, they're achievable, that perhaps not all students can, and part of the concern was if you try to fund a system that says all students, that the incremental cost of moving the last students up the last notch may be so high that would really disadvantage, because the cost is so high, it would disadvantage other students as well. But there was a clear expectation that there would be continued growth for all students.
If I just may follow up comment, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the Portland District, our performance expectation is for 100% of the students. And I remain concerned about the 90%, because again, it is a statement that we don't believe somehow that another group of students won't be able to to achieve. That's troubling to me, because it's somebody's child. And I'll leave it there, but also say that I think that that's an issue that needs to be revisited, and that I'm going to urge that we revise it at some point. Whatever the process is for achieving that, I think we need to move there.
Thank you, Senator Cordley. I would like bring forward a little data that we talked about in the last session, and that is in 1995 there was indications that there's 16 million students with an individual education plan across America, and of that number, 15 million. That would amount to 93%+. Were on that individual education plan simply because they were not taught to read. They had no disability as far as being able to actually read. And I, like Senator Gordley, believe that we leave no child behind, that they all should be taught to read. And I'm going to be very interested. I don't see anything in these expressed expectations here about changing our method of instruction so that every child will read. If, in fact, we buy more of the failed reading program that currently in place across our state, we will have a failed system in 4 years, and no child will be substantially improving their capability of reading. We must address the issue of how children are taught to read. And so we'll be talking about that a lot this legislative session. Thank you.
I'd like to turn it back over to Linda now to talk about the Department of Education.
This is just the final slide on school funding. I know I'm hearing these numbers, and sometimes it's a little bit easier if you can place them in some context. School funding generally, besides the state school fund and the school improvement fund that we just talked about, there's a couple of small packages in the budget for a data integrity assurance package to upgrade and consolidate school data systems. There's also the funding for the local option equalization grants that were a part of Measure 1. This is going to be a real quick overview on the Department of Ed, except for school funding. This also takes out the debt service, which is funded through the Department of Ed. You can see the department has almost a 17% increase in the governor's budget over last legislatively approved budget, and a 2.6% increase over current service level in the general fund portion of their budget. A few of the major budget issues in the current service level is debt service. The debt service for the 0103 biennium is $58 million, which is paying off the lottery bonds from the last two bienniums. A few of the enhancements, Gene's already talked about the assistance to low-performing schools, a little bit of funding for teacher mentor programs, student dropout prevention programs that would specifically be targeted towards high school and middle school, and $5.9 million for expansion of the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, which would bring that up to service of 60% of eligible kids. The department also had some reductions to help pay for some of the enhancements. The biggest was regional programs, social science assessment development, a delay of that, and Together for Children program.
Now we're moving on to the community colleges and workforce development budget. Again, in terms of thinking through kind of the philosophy of the governor in developing the budget in this manner, Most of you are probably aware of the impact on community colleges by NEM of their enrollment growth and not having any money for enrollment growth. And so I think that during the first year, many of them were forced to put people on a waiting list or turn people away or close down sections of program, and I think most probably raised tuition as well. In developing this budget, the governor wanted to be able to address the capacity issue. The system capacity of the system is important as you look at this, and it's similar, it's true of the university system. How can we expand capacity so that students have access to community college programs? And that was more important, perhaps, than individual institution capacity. And so you will see in here that there were some reductions or elimination of state funding for some specific programs that may have been in place at specific campuses. And so different institutions are impacted differently because some may have had those programs and may not be seeing a lot of enrollment growth. But again, this is part of the trade-off. It's always important to keep the pipeline of community colleges open, whether it's a pipeline to then a four-year degree, a pipeline to provide remedial based adult-based education services, or the pipeline for professional technical to help students upgrade their skills so they can continue in the workforce.
The enhancement for community colleges is a $45 million for enrollment growth. Enrollment has been over 4% in community colleges the last 2 years, and we expect it will be again this year. As Jean said, there's a number of reductions that either were not really considered core mission or did not benefit all colleges. There were more specific, certainly no one thought they were bad programs. The total of the reductions is about $13 million.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hordley.
I would just like to point out one thing, and it's triggered by what you just said about some of these reductions or programs being seen as not part of the core mission. And the feedback on this mic is driving me a little nuts.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at the the skill centers, including the Saban Skill Center. Actually, those skill centers are part of the of what we call the economic and community development strategy to assist our urban and rural distressed communities. I mean, there's another way of looking at it, at these two programs. Some of us tend to look at it and just say it's education and it's community college budget, but actually these are programs that are helping to that are helping a lot of citizens in our underserved and distressed communities gain skills so that they can be full participants in their communities and in the economy. So there's another way of looking at these particular packages, and I just wanted to say that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
please. I would also like to echo the remarks of Senator Gordley and wanted to just, I was wanting to know, do you remember what the price tag was on the additional state funding for the Basic Skills Center at Sixth Community College? Do you remember what the breakdown for that was?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, $3.4 million.
$3.4 million.
Okay.
As we move to the
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Perioli,
the enhancements for enrollment growth are absolutely critical, and I think the governor's to be commended for recognizing the precipitous growth in those areas. But I agree with my colleagues from Portland and Lane County. We spent years in developing regional partnerships in the school-to-work programs between higher education and high schools, and in reclamation of dropout students that seem to do very well in a GED program or a matriculant program that puts them into a community college. And we particularly look at the Saving Skills Center model as a model that we like to see replicated in other places where job creating opportunities and real skills for real world applications are taught. And also those basic skills centers where people get hands-on life learning opportunities that give them job opportunities in a changing environment and a changing economy, like we're experiencing most of rural Oregon at the present time. And then we've beefed up Oregon University's advanced technology engineering schools and centered those in urban areas. At the same time, we appear to be eliminating funding of advanced technology centers elsewhere in the state. And so what I see in the reductions is a destruction of partnership, a pulling back of school-to-work opportunities, walking away from over a decade of commitment that we've had to connecting high schools to community colleges to transfer degrees to higher education. And then we're losing the backstop of the highly specialized technical education for students who need the lifelong learning but are non-matriculant students. So again, this is a budget of withdrawal and denial, not empowerment and education. We do need the enrollment growth portion. I guess if I have to look at prioritizations, I just cannot support these reductions. Not coming from rural communities and distressed communities as we do.
Appreciate it very much.
Mr. Chair.
Other comments?
Yes. I just can't miss an opportunity to say that a part of our denial, though, is failing to recognize that if we're going to get out of this, we're going to need more revenue. We're not the revenue committee. I know that. But we're in denial here. As a state, we don't have to go down this path. We don't have to, but we are choosing to, because we're choosing not to have the other conversation, which is about increasing revenues so that we don't do this kind of destruction to real people in real communities around the state. That's a political message. I recognize that, but this is my opportunity to say it.
Mr. Chairman, heaven forbid anybody accuses of doing anything political.
Thank you. Would you continue with your presentation?
Chair, as we move to the last couple of slides on the Department of Higher Ed, again, a little bit about the philosophy behind this. Higher education can be many different matters, and I think as the governor looked at the core mission, if you look at the statutes for higher education, they are quite broad, but I think that from the governor, and they could argue with this, that the core mission of higher education is instruction. And so as we looked at the type of reductions and enhancements, we're both trying to look at that core mission of instruction. For those of you who are familiar with the budget, the new budget model from OUS, we tried as much as possible on the cells or the student side to preserve that, although there is, what we believe, a reasonable tuition increase in here, which is after 4 years of the tuition freeze, and to focus down on kind of the line item or the target program side. In addition, the governor was saying these are important investments we need to make to deal with some of the changing economic and geographic circumstances in the state. So that was what was behind it, as Linda said, to discuss the higher ed.
You can see here on the summary, higher ed did take a 3.5% decrease in their budget from their current service level, which left a 1% increase from the legislatively approved budget last time. Here's a summary of the enhancements and reductions. Some of the investments, the $20 million to improve education for engineering and to increase the number of engineering and computer science graduates. $7 million to expand higher education in Central Oregon. It's expected 400 to 700 students by the end of the 2103 biennium. $17 million for enrollment growth and $8 million for small schools, which it was felt that the budget model doesn't adequately address needs of the smallest universities. Although they're not officially in higher ed, there is a $10 million increase for OHSU of tobacco settlement funds to expand the biotechnology research there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher. I apologize. I had a matter I had to take care of there a second or two, and I didn't get to ask a question I wanted to ask on the previous enhancements and reductions there on the community college. And I'm going to ask it on this also. Seems a little bit strange. You have enhancements always on these things. The amount that gets enhanced. And then the reductions, but strangely enough, we don't know how much those reductions are. Did we really get any enhancement? Or did we get more reductions than we got enhancement? What's the price tag on all the reductions? I found out it was $3.4 million on just that one alone. What are the totals?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, for community colleges, the total reductions are just under $13 million. And I'd be glad, for ways and means, we put a lot more of the numbers in,
yeah.
And I'd be glad to give you those references.
Well, that's what, and also then on this next one, these are up here too, on the Department of Higher Ed major budget, you've got a list of enhancements there for, looks like a neighborhood of about $37-38 million. But, and the reductions down there, what is the total reduction number?
Total reductions is $95 million.
So, in reality, it's been reduced way a lot more than it's been enhanced.
Mr. Senator Fisher, within that $95 million is $25 million of tuition, which is, it involves a tuition increase, which would be, in essence, a cost shift from general fund to tuition. So there is about $70 million program reduction in the higher ed.
So twice as much reduction.
Right. Senator Fisher, if you look at all the pieces, you end up with about an $18 million reduction from current service levels.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was 1.7 there. I was adding it wrong. I apologize. It's instead of 37 or 38, it's about 7, 14, about 51. Yeah, okay.
I'll just go through the list of the reductions quickly just to give you a sense. And again, keeping in mind that the attempt was to keep it out of the basic instruction. The elimination of some of the supplemental funding that allows individual campuses to collaborate with community colleges and other campuses, $2.8 million. Reduction of funding for statewide and for campus-based public services, about $20 million. And the list goes on. Reduction of centralized services, that would be out of the chancellor's office. And administrative support is about $15.7 million. Reduction of support for non-resident master's students and internship programs is $2.5 million. Reduction of state support for research, $10 million. Reduction of the state subsidy, part of the state subsidy, the veterinary and pharmacy programs, is $2.8 million. There were actually a number of other smaller reductions. And then down at the bottom, you see that the tuition increase is expected to offset about $25 million of those reductions.
One thing I'd like to point out on the higher ed budget, because it's a little more difficult working on going through a budget development process when you're dealing with the board, because you can't have the kind of interactions that are necessary in developing the budget, and so the budget development occurred more with the staff and the university. governor has met with the Board of Higher Ed and invited them, and I met with the Board's Budget Committee yesterday, that if they believe there are other policy options within this budget, again, within the amount, that he would certainly be willing to consider, listen to those, consider those for presentation to you when the Department of Higher Ed does come to present the budget. And with that, I think that provides a overview of the major parts of, major general fund parts of the education budget.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Just one comment. It has been so hard to get our university system, higher ed system, to acknowledge that there's some advantage in having some liaison with our community colleges, when other private colleges and our community colleges have paved the way and provided such a service to us in the local areas. That seems passing strange to me that those would be some of the first things reduced when you would try to get some kind of thing going out of your budget that would try to help the citizens of this state who are having to drive mile after mile after mile to get things anyway in a local community college, and yet put it to the point where they are even further stressed. And to me, it kind of smacks of, you won't give me the money, so I'll just nail your hide, like the local school budget people used to do and say, well, you won't pass our budget, there goes the sports and busing. I would think that there could be some things, matter of fact, I'll make you an offer. I've made Cox and a few of the presidents, you give me 4 hours on any one of our university campuses and I'll show you where you can save some money that won't be cutting out a whole lot of programs that hurt anything. I'd make that without any qualifications, and I've never been taken up on it yet.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, I mean, let me respond to both parts there. I think the last part of your offer is partially what was behind the governor saying to the board, if there are other choices here that you think would make more sense, he certainly is willing to consider them. I think that we were faced with the information that we had and utilize that information to make some decisions about the recommended budget. As far as some of the partnerships, I certainly think it's not an issue of not valuing partnerships. When the regional part, there's two pieces. There's some regional partnership money in community college and then in higher ed. The governor, in speaking to the joint boards, which are over them, both the Board of Education is over K-12 and community college, and the Board of Higher Ed is over higher ed. The joint boards meet together on a regular basis, and as probably 3 years ago, the governor had talked about regional partnerships, that the money there should be really seen as venture capital, that it should be used for startup, but then the long-term continuation of partnerships should be carried on the back of enrollment dollars instead of looking at, well, we need extra state money in order to be able to engage in a partnership. And so there were three partnerships at the beginning, and there's still the same three partnerships now. The funding in the community college budget was reduced. It was not eliminated, but with the understanding that the joint boards could look at the partnerships that were in existence and say, perhaps they're one of the three, maybe more deserving than the other, or however that they felt it was appropriate to split that. But it was more the issue of should there be, Can the partnerships only occur when there's additional state money on the line? And in some ways, it goes back also, I think, to the issue around Save and Spill Center. Save and Spill Center is a wonderful place, and I'm not saying it's not. But at the same time, we have, for instance, the Reynolds, Centennial, Gresham, Bartlett districts have come together with Mount Good Community College, and they're developing their own regional Skills Center without state money. They're pooling their resources. And so I think part of the issue is how can some of these things occur through a pooling of resources as opposed to saying we can only make them occur if there's additional state money involved. And given the fiscal constraints that we had, I think the governor thought it was more important to utilize the money to increase the access.
Mr. Chair, that skill center is a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because those skill centers were developed and they stopped just before they got to Umpqua Community College on the way up to the Willamette Valley. And I guess I could say this, give us our skill center like everybody else got, and we'll take a shot at funding ourselves.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one really brief thought, and it came on a couple slides back on the higher ed reductions and the money that was added is, and I know we see millions of scary statistics, but one that I saw a few weeks ago was that Oregon ranked 50th amongst 50 states in terms of the investment per capita in engineering education. And at a time when the economy is absolutely, and Washington is making real investments, obviously, in higher education in general and also in technology and engineering, I think that bodes very, very poorly for our economic ability to compete in a new economy and in the knowledge-based economy of the 21st century. And so that is the area that just really... We see a lot of statistics that are alarming, but none alarmed me more than that one, at least at the moment.
Thank you very much. This has been informative and helpful. We will be very cognizant of these issues, or the funding, as we look at policy issues surrounding that funding. And so I know Senator Hartung has had this presentation previously and is at the point of having enough of it, but he's the one that's going to be in the driver's seat, I think, and I appreciate that he is and that he's part of this committee as well. Again, thank you very much. Thank you. We have two small measures before us today, and I believe that we can handle them rather quickly, and then we can participate with our friends out in the Native Americans out here. I would like to move to a public hearing and probable work session. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 254 and invite Greg McMurdo to come tell us how this helps us in our efficiency and the performance of our duties.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Greg McMurdo and I represent the Department of Education. Senate Bill 254 would authorize the Superintendent of Public Instruction to execute contracts with a facsimile signature if two conditions were met, and one is that the contract must be for personal services, and the second is that the contract must be for $3,000 or less. The bill addresses a problem that we encountered last year when we were contracting for persons that score the statewide assessments. By contracting with these individuals as independent contractors, we were able to save a fair amount of money with respect to those contracts. Unfortunately, in reviewing these, the form we were using, the Department of Justice advised us that we didn't have the authority to use facsimile signatures. And that because of that, each contract would have to be manually signed. And I might add, each contract requires two signatures, one on the contract itself, and then one certifying that the contractor, to the best of our knowledge, is an independent contractor. There were over 3,500 contractors, so that was over 7,000 signatures, which was very time-consuming. For the limited number of department staff that have the authority to execute contracts on the department's behalf. So we are proposing in this bill to be able to use facsimile signatures in a similar fashion that other state agencies have. I would like to emphasize that each contract would still be processed through our accounting system, and each contract would still acquire a unique encumbrance number. So there certainly is security for those contracts. It would merely eliminate the necessity of hand signing those contracts.
Any discussion, question?
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you defined personal services. I was wondering how many $3,000 contracts were going to be needed for dry cleaning of his clothes and shining of his shoes. And
thank you.
I don't see, Senator Fisher.
I don't see any reason that we shouldn't expedite things that are being done commonly in the business world of this day and apply it to us. Goodness knows we've got a little enough of that type of thing going for us anyway, so I certainly have no objection.
There are no further questions. I'll close the hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 254. Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept Senate Bill 254 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Fisher has moved that we pass Senate Bill 254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? If not, so ordered. And let Senator Decker carry that one. Open that public hearing on Senate Bill 326. Ask Mr. Grattan-Currens to come and explain this proposal to us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
When I took a look at this bill, I thought it was like the movie Groundhog Day or something. I remembered this from last session.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Grattan-Currens, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 326, which was introduced at the request of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. SB 326 can be described as the quintessential housekeeping bill. Adoption of the measure will simply place in statute the current public name of the university system and make no other change in the purpose or mission of the OUS. The measure was introduced to avoid confusion between the statutory references in the ORSs to the state system of higher education, what we used to call ASHI, and the designation the State Board of Higher Education gave to the Department of Higher Education in January 1998, when by adopting a board resolution to use the name Oregon University System and logo that you associate with the OUS today. Following the board's action, the OUS name and logo were registered with the Corporation Division of the Office of Secretary of State as the registered business name of the public university system. But this statute, if you approve it, would make the statutory designation for the university system, its publicly recognized, and its registered name be the same. The board would ask for your favorable consideration of the measure to have a unified name for your public university system.
Any questions? I'm going to close public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 326.
Chair?
Senator Castillo.
I move that we adopt Senate Bill 326 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Castillo has moved that we approve Senate Bill 326, sending it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Gordon, would you carry Senate Bill 326, please?
Sure.
Thank you. Any other matters come before our meeting today? Not, we will adjourn the Education Committee. Thank you, Patty.